Good morning and welcome to the April 3, 2023 meeting of the Chelan Public Utilities Commission. Today there are four commissioners present. Commissioner McKenna has been excused for today. And our normal staff are here. Manager Kirk Hudson, Clerk of the Board Rebecca Newman, and General Counsel Eric Walquist. I would ask everyone to check your electronic devices, which I haven't done yet, so I'll do it myself. Make sure they're on placed on the silent mode to assist in not disrupting today's meeting. We do value the public input at our meetings and will be providing an opportunity for the public to have input at the end of our morning session and at the end of the afternoon session. If you wish to speak, we ask that you come to the microphone here at the table, provide your name and address for the record, as our meetings are recorded and we wish to have an accurate record of your input. We additionally ask that you limit your comments to 3 minutes. Additionally, if you wish to speak to any of the agenda items today, I would provide that opportunity at the end of each item. That being said, our flag salute and our safety minute this morning will be brought to us by Annika Kallstrom, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about her because I just met her a few minutes ago. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, good morning. My name is Annika Kallstrom, and I'm going to be presenting the Safety Minute today. I want to start by telling you something that I love about working here at the district. That is that I get to make a tangible difference in the lives of people here in Chelan County. I want you to close your eyes for a second and imagine you get home this afternoon and you walk into your house and you go to turn on a light and nothing happens. You try a couple more lights and you decide, oh no, the power's out. What are you going to do? I think there's a ton of upsides to electrification. It makes our lives easier in so many ways. But there are a few downsides, and I want to talk about one of those today. So, electrification has allowed us to live our lives pretty independent of natural light, sunlight. We can kind of pick our own rhythm and go with it. And that's resulted in us getting less sleep than we have in the past. So I'm going to pull up a statistic. In 1950, people got on average 8 hours of sleep a night. And that same statistic in 2019, people are getting 6.5 hours of sleep a night. That's a pretty dramatic drop when you think that the recommended amount of sleep for adults to get is 7 to 9 hours. Like, we're not hitting that target. Right. So, but you might be thinking to yourself, okay, we're all really busy. We have to-do lists that are way longer than we have hours in the day. Like, you know, what do? You got to get stuff done. So why does it really matter? Why do we care? Well, a couple things are, each year, there are 6,000 people that lose their lives due to car crashes caused by drowsy driving. And in fact, it's estimated that 1 in 10 car crashes is caused by drowsy driving. So that's, you know, significant and serious. On more of a personal health front, being chronically sleep deprived can cause your brain to age 3 to 5 years. And it can also cause a 33% increase in the risk of developing dementia. It also makes you 3 times more likely to catch a cold. We can probably all relate to being at a point where you just feel really worn out and tired and you're like, oh man, I think I'm going to get sick. It's a real thing. It's going to cause difficulty in multitasking, you know, as you go throughout your day. We all got a lot going on. And it makes us more prone to making mistakes. So from a human performance perspective, that's huge. If you're going to open yourself up to making a lot more mistakes, that's a game changer. And finally, it can cause an increase in anxiety and depression. Just last week, there were a couple days that I didn't get enough sleep, and I was just kind of feeling like crummy and down. And then there was a night that I went to bed really early. I slept in a little bit later, and the difference that it made was huge. The next morning, I woke up rested, energized, calm, worshipful. It was just night and day difference between being sleep deprived and getting enough rest. So couple statistics. If you go 24 hours without getting any sleep, that is basically the same as having a 0.1% blood alcohol level, which is above the legal driving limit. So that's serious, you know, going that long without sleep. By the time you hit 36 hours without sleep, your body will start to microsleep, which is when you have these brief periods of sleeping that last up to 30 seconds. And then by the time you hit 48 hours, you're experiencing more severe microsleep and even hallucinating. You're seeing and experiencing things that are not really there. So obviously a huge problem. Okay, but what are we actually supposed to do? I've just outlined, you know, this is a problem, this is really bad, but how are we supposed to change? Well, there's a couple things that we can avoid, and that is caffeine late in the day. This is mostly being aware, like, oh, you know, I'm feeling tired, you know, maybe caffeine would help me for the next couple hours, but it might cause me to not sleep well tonight, which is going to affect my day tomorrow. I don't want to be in the same boat again tomorrow, right? And then the next thing is screens before bedtime. This one is huge, and this kind of comes back to where we talk about electrification, and our devices can always be on, and if we're looking at them, that can really affect us. So I'm going to put a quote up here. This is from a sleep expert at Harvard. He says, every time we turn on a light, we are inadvertently taking a drug that affects how we sleep. So it's really interesting. Not all the wavelengths on the visible light spectrum are equal. Actually, blue light is a lot worse. So blue light in particular causes the body to suppress releasing melatonin, which is a hormone that helps you calm down, relax, go to sleep. So looking at devices before bedtime can have a big effect on you actually being able to get a good night's rest. And so one thing that I would really encourage each of us to do is dig into your phone settings and see what's configurable, what you can make work for you. So for example, on my phone, I have nighttime mode. So during a set amount of hours, I can say, hey, I want a blue light blocker. So it's going to turn my color scheme more, you know, yellowy colors and pull the blue light out of my phone. So if I do have to look at it, it's not going to have that same effect on my brain. And then there's a lot more in phone settings too. You can adjust notifications, calls, you know, what kind of stuff is going to be able to get through to you at what hours. So, and I think this is really key, is finding what works for you. So for me, I'm part of the energy planning and trading systems team. And so our group is responsible for maintaining these data sets that our traders use to make great trading decisions. And then we also have different data sets that we pass on to system operations. And those are critical for our system operators to be able to reliably operate the grid. And so if there's a problem with one of those data sets and it goes down in the middle of the night, they need to be able to reach me or one of my colleagues. So unfortunately, I have to sleep with my phone next to me because it's important that they can get through to us if they need to. And so, you know, maybe in my settings, I'm going to say, hey, I do want to be able to get calls, but maybe I don't want to get notifications if my friends are going back and forth and group me, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's just all about finding what works for you. So another thing that we can do, and I think this one's really interesting, is expose yourself to natural light. So studies have actually shown that the more that you are out in natural light during the course of a day, the less of a negative effect artificial light will have on you. So, you know, maybe if you're getting out, getting a walk, you're out in the sunshine during your day, it's not going to be as bad if you do have to look at your phone around bedtime. Another thing is improving your sleeping environment. So maybe you're like, oh, I need blackout curtains, or the cat keeps scratching at my door. I need to make a change. It's worth it to proactively do what you can to make sure that you have a great day tomorrow. Another thing is exercise. That's huge in you being able to sleep well and get good rest. The one caveat there is not to exercise right before bed. So, you know, maybe just don't plan your trip to the gym and then try to go to sleep right after that. It might not work out well. Keeping a set schedule is huge. There are so many productivity experts that have said morning routines and evening routines are absolutely key in making sure that you have a great day. And another one is creating a nighttime routine that works for you, that you look forward to. So a lot of times for me, when I hit a certain time, I say, okay, I'm not going to force myself to go to bed right now, because oftentimes I'll feel like I'm so wound up, I could never go to sleep. But through the course of getting ready for bed, I calm down and then I actually can rest. So it's all about keeping the routine, keeping something that works for you that will generally help you to get to your goal. And finally, if you are behind on sleep, have a plan to catch back up. So there's this idea of sleep debt, and that is the difference between the amount of sleep that you should get and what you actually get. And recognizing that over time, if you're getting less sleep than you should, you're accumulating this debt, and it does affect you. So if you're getting behind, you know, realize I've got to do something different going forward. I got to come up with a plan to catch back up. So those are some things that we can do to be more rested. Now I will say, are there any questions?
Commissioners, any questions?
No, I enjoyed your presentation.
Very
though.
Much. Very,
thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
So tell me a little bit more about you. You're in energy planning and trading.
Yes.
I may be incorrect in my observation, but when you led us in the flag salute, I thought, this lady's been in the military.
Mm. I have not, but I do really appreciate our armed forces.
You were so at attention with your arm behind your back. It was really neat to watch.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
So before the utility, are you from here?
No, I grew up in northeastern Oregon, and then I went to school at Oregon Tech, and I studied renewable energy engineering and electrical engineering. And while I was in school, I came across hydropower. I actually wrote about it for a technical paper I had, and it really kind of opened my eyes to the world of hydropower. And I'm really passionate about hydropower because I think it's an incredible, you know, renewable energy and resource that can integrate really well with other renewables, and it's reliable. So that kind of set my course to wanting to pursue a career in hydropower. So I had the privilege to intern up at Rocky Reach with the Engineering and Project Management Group in 2019. And then when I graduated in 2020, I came to the Energy Planning and Trading Group and get to do lots of interesting work there. So I love working at the district.
Welcome to Chelan County.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any other? Good. You bet.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So item 2 on our agenda is the approval of the agenda, and it's at this time any item on the consent agenda shall be subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon the request of any commission member. Also, additionally, I believe Resolution 11 has been recommended for placement on the consent agenda by management, and if there's no objections by any commissioner, we will do so. Any objections? Very good. We'll move to item 3, orderly electrical load growth.
Andy Wendell's going to join us. Welcome, Andy.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, commissioners. Here we are in April for our first 2023 quarterly electric load update. I just wanted to mention that this load update is preluded by various subject matter experts in the organization that come together on a regular basis and look at energy projections, energy use projections, primarily out of our retail customers. And we look historical, but we look forward to try to project, you know, how much electricity we're going to need to serve, you know, the next 3 to 5 years. As a result of that, we put out what is generally an annual, maybe sometimes biannual, forecast for energy needs. So, and in addition, we talk about a lot of other things about new applications and things going on with the electric grid, including our infrastructure. Okay. So on the agenda, we've got our 2022 actuals for electric meters, new services, and as I mentioned, meter projections. We have our countywide developments. We'll talk about our update on Mission Ridge, as well as some of the peak demand we saw in December. And then we'll finish with our substation build plan. There's no action requested today. This is just informational only. So this slide shows our basically our historical meters per year. And you can see that we average around 1,000 electric meters per year. The blue is residential meters. The green is commercial and industrial meters. The green is commercial meters. And then the industrial meters are in red, which you can see there's very few new industrial meters. Year to date, we're a little slow getting out of the gates this year, particularly on the residential meters. But I can assure you we're going to catch up. There's several multifamily housing units and other developments that are, as the weather breaks, very active under construction. So we are projecting around 800 new electric meters again this year, very similar to 2021 and 2022. Here's some notable applications. By no means is this a complete list of applications, but we do have some new interesting ones coming into our spectrum this first quarter. Leavenworth Meadows, the actual Men property in Leavenworth, there's around 300 units planned with a variety of different, you know, multifamily as well as some single family residences in that area. And they're in the final design stages, and because of the proximity of our substation in Leavenworth, the PUD is working very closely with the Men property to ensure that we have the electric infrastructure needed, but we can also pass through that property to be able to get our substation feeders properly situated over the next couple of years. Multifamily housing structures in Eniat, you can see these, I guess they would be east of the highway, down towards the river area. Lots of new construction in the multifamily structure spectrum in the Eniat area, and more to come. Leavenworth, we just received application for a new La Quinta Hotel behind the Safeway in Leavenworth. I think it's around 60 rooms, although that hasn't been finalized yet. And then a new interesting one is an inquiry from the Colville tribes to locate a casino expansion on their property behind the existing casino in the Manson area. That would equate to about 100 room hotel room and a big gaming area as well. That load is signaled to be somewhere between 1 and 5 megawatts, and as you know, that's a pretty big spread, so we're trying to pin them down on exactly what that load is. At this point in time, they're signaling this is primarily feasibility. I would note that the new North Shore substation that's actually under construction today, we'll talk a little bit more about, is necessary to be able to serve this load. So timing is of interest here for sure. Okay, to that 10-year load forecast, I won't spend a lot of time on this, but I just wanted to remind everybody that this is that load forecast that is net of energy conservation plans. So each year our energy conservation group conserves a pro rata share of energy, and that's subtracted from our total load growth here. So this is kind of netting that out. Also, this view excludes some of those large loads, that we've had conversations with in the south end of the county down in the Malaga area. So it's primarily focused around what we would refer to as our retail and organic load growth. You can see that the load forecast is 15 average megawatts, or about 0.7% growth. That has not shifted since the last time we reported, November of 2022. In our base case, 15 average megawatts. In a high case, 47 average megawatts. In a low case, around 6 average megawatts. Just to note that our load forecast team will be publishing another forecast in around the August and September of 2023 timeframe, and we'll likely see a few changes there. Okay, I want to shift gears and talk a little bit about peak energy demand, and in particular on those really cold days in December of 2022, just before Christmas. This slide shows on the left-hand side, it shows the megawatts, and on the right-hand side, it shows the temperature, and the temperature's inverted, okay? So you can see there on December 22nd, on Thursday, we saw a peak demand, an instantaneous peak demand of around 563, almost 564 megawatts. At 0 degrees, or actually at 1 degree Fahrenheit at 8:25 a.m. There's also a 60-minute average, which is slightly lower, the blue dot just below that. So this is significantly higher than we've seen in the past. And it basically has changed some of our views around some of our distribution assets to be able to serve that peak demand. And just as a reminder, you know, we design our electric system to meet the peak demand, that coldest period, that coldest day, that coldest hour of the year. Unlike a lot of the other things we do, we look at average energy but from an infrastructure standpoint, we're focused on that worst condition, which is that instantaneous peak that you can see here. So we're in uncharted territory in terms of peak energy usage on our system. So how did we fare on the electric system within the county December 22nd? Well, overall, it functioned as planned. We designed for, you know, these with some safety factors built into our system, and for the most part, it functioned very well. Point of interest, it occurred over a holiday break, and as a result, there was a lot of folks in the Chelan and Manson area, as well as the Leavenworth area, on vacation, right? VRBOs and filled up hotel rooms, and school was out. It was Christmas break. So that changed the load profile a little bit. Our schools didn't see the same amount of load, but certainly in the residential areas and the vacation areas, we saw a lot more demand in those particular areas. As I mentioned, we saw a lot more peak demand on several of our substations and our distribution feeders across the county. It wasn't just in Leavenworth there. It was certainly across the county. We did see some losses in our system, some fuses, and we saw some higher than expected demand, but overall, fairly low impact. We did, of course, see the feeders in the Leavenworth substation out for a sustained period of time, and we navigated through that. But overall, we functioned fairly well. One final note on that is I would just say that you'll see where we've made some adjustments in our substation build plan based on those peak demands. this slide basically shows our substation portfolio across the county, where the gray are the existing substations. Kind of the yellow or orange are future substations where we have property that's acquired, but we're in some level of planning and design. And then the red substations are where we aspire to have a substation. We don't have property. We're working on plans. Those are our targeted areas for our property acquisitions. You can see in the Chelan area, there's a couple that are developing. The Roses Lake, Dry Lake vicinity, which would complement our existing Manson substation. That is an example of one that we're going to be accelerating from a location standpoint based on those peak demands and based on the loads that we've seen over the last few years. But we're not alone on that. In Cashmere, we know that we need to move some things up as well. And then the Stamilt substation down in the Malaga particular area. So again, just in summary, we have 34 existing substations. There's 13 additional substations between the orange and the red ones there that we are aspiring to have installed. Here's just another view of those same substations. They're kind of listed in basically in terms of a priority of what we're working on most. The North Shore substation, as many of you are aware, is now under construction, and we plan to have that in service at the end of the year. The Leavenworth substation or Bavarian substation is also active. Wenatchee substation, Castle Rock substation, and the West Wenatchee substation. I just draw your attention down to the Mission Ridge substation. We're going to provide an update on that. That's, what is that, number 10 or so on the list. It shows on there for a year of 2030 to be put into service. That's based on organic load growth. But we know the substation expansion, the Mission Ridge ski area expansion plan may change that target date somewhat. A little more refined look, North Shore substation, as I mentioned, is under construction. It's planned to be in service in Q4 2023. The Leavenworth Bavarian substation, we're working through permitting and environmental review at this point in time. It's spent a little bit more time in permitting and environmental review than we had liked, but it's an important step for us. So we should have that completed by the end of Q2 of 2023 and be able to move into more of a final design standpoint. Upsizing the existing Wenatchee substation, which is basically an expansion. We purchased some property just adjacent to the existing substation so we could expand that yard. That additional property is going through an environmental review right now. We hope to have that completed by Q4 of 2023. The Wenatchee foothills or West Wenatchee, we'll do a little bit more deeper dive into that but we're working on siting and utility planning with a target of Q3 2023. And then, as I mentioned, the Malaga substation as well, from a property acquisition standpoint. And various other rehabs going on with our existing stations, just improvements to those existing stations. Hey, here's a great one. This is a celebratory photo here on the screen. A lot of sweat and some tears. To get to where we are today with the North Shore substation. Gary Rice, our engineer, he's been instrumental in seeing this project to fruition. Took this photo and sent it to me. We're well on our way there. So excited about progress on the North Shore substation. Just as a reminder, the substations do work as a network. They don't work independently, and so the North Shore substation, once put into place, will relieve pressure on the adjacent substations, such as the Union Valley and the Manson and Wapato substations. So they'll benefit everybody on the North Shore of Lake Chelan, in addition to customers in the city of Chelan as well. Here's a look at our West Wenatchee area substation siting. This is an aerial photo. What you're looking at there is the Washington State Tree Fruit Research property. You have Western Street going north and south, and then down toward the bottom you have Springwater Street going east and west. I can't recall exactly how many acres are there. I want to say around 9 acres. I may be off there, but you can see the four magenta areas numbered 1, 2, 3, and 4. Essentially, the Tree Fruit Research, the Washington State University Tree Fruit Research Administration, is allowing us to look at the feasibility of siting a substation on their property under a long-term property lease. And we're going through that process today. We've done some early feasibility work, and we've done some public outreach. In fact, we held a meeting on February 21st, invited folks. So we had about 20, 25 people come in. We talked about the why we need a substation, the importance of it, and why we're looking on these particular properties. We got some great feedback from folks. We asked them thoughts, their concerns, what they thought about it. As you can imagine, aesthetics are, one of the primary considerations. We did, after the 21st, we did a public viewing where public residences and business owners around the area could come and walk the property with our engineers to kind of take a look at what we're thinking about and have some ideas and be able to kind of look at some of those view corridors. And then we're doing another presentation to the Heritage Haven Homeowners Association that's located just directly north of the site's just above that magenta line. We're doing that in a couple weeks, and we'll get their insights as well. So before we finalize a property location or one of the site locations. So it's a good community engagement process. We've been getting great feedback so far, and we anticipate good good partnerships with the neighborhoods moving forward on the substation siting. So. Okay, I'm going to shift gears here. We'll talk a little bit about Mission Ridge. This particular view is showing a distribution line or the feeder that feeds the Mission Ridge ski area in addition to Squilchuck, the main Squilchuck corridor. On the left-hand side, we have capacity in megawatts and the percent of that capacity. Basically, in 2017, you can see that our load was right at about 75% on that particular feeder. That's below our planning threshold, right? That's when we received an application from Mission Ridge for their expansion plans. And we've been volleying that application back and forth for a few years, just trying to understand the timing, the actual loads that they're going to need. Interesting enough, as we've been continuing to do that over the last 5 years, what has demand on that feeder been doing? That organic load growth has been increasing, right? Just as we're working through that, 2021, we saw a big increase, and here we are in December of 2022, we hit about 95% of that feeder capacity, right? So that pushes
it. That seems like that's really fast. Mm-hmm. Has there been a lot of new homes up there?
You know, there's been a variety of different, or what I would refer to as organic growth, and Mission Ridge is part of that, right? They've added some facilities as well. But there have been some residential developments, not huge ones, some 6, 8, 10 lot developments. Also, we see more pumping activity from irrigation water and orchards in that particular area. It just flat out creeped up on us. But
it looks fast.
Yeah, it looks fast, exactly. What's interesting about that is you can see at that 8 megawatts or that 80%, that's kind of where our planning standard is. And our planning standard says when a substation feeder or a substation reaches about 80%, we should be planning. We should have plans in place to respond to that. Unfortunately, between that 80% and that 95%, it moved pretty darn quick. Yeah. We usually have a few more years in there, but... again, these are peak loads, right? This is what we saw in December 2022. So as a result, as you can imagine, we've reached or exceeded our planning threshold. We're taking action on that now, and engineers are actively working on putting plans together to respond to that. So in 2023, we're performing more comprehensive planning and budgeting for relief of that capacity increase on Squilchuck. It's going to include some distribution improvements, but in that, we'll also wrap in kind of that long-range forecast for substation needs, not only for the Mission Ridge expansion, but also our particular needs based on organic growth.
Andy, what would long-range be? How many years?
Usually, that's looking anywhere between 20 and 50 years, right? So we'll be looking out there a ways for that. I think... Commissioner Allen, to answer your question specifically, we want to try to sharpshoot when we predict we'll need that substation up there. Mm-hmm. And then as you may know, today we've changed our substation standard to be able to put in two power transformers at each substation rather than one, which significantly increases the life expectancy in terms of capacity for that substation. It doubles it from 28 megawatts to 56. So long range.
I can ask the question.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thanks, Andy. There's been talk of Mission Ridge expanding, matter of fact, doing so fairly significantly according to their plans. As you're considering a new substation up in that area, are you factoring in what the blueprint plans are for Mission Ridge and the development that they're talking about someday happening up there?
Yeah, Commissioner Arsenal, excellent question. And the answer is yes. We are factoring what Mission Ridge is asking or is projecting to do. And here's the way we're approaching that. Basically, we're looking at our long-range forecasting that would look at organic growth. And then we're going to take a second derivative of that analysis and try to bake in what we know about Mission Ridge expansion plan. right? When it is occurring and over what period of time. They've signaled to us that it's a multi-year plan, so we'll try to bake that into our plan. If it results in accelerating the need for a substation, then we'll provide them that option, but we'll need to talk about how we offset those, accelerating those costs to the district as well. So we're working through that process right now, but we're certainly keeping Mission Ridge expansion plan and the timeline, or what we call a ramping plan for them, we're keeping that in mind to see how well that aligns with our capital improvement plans.
That's great. Thanks, Andy. That's kind of a sticky one. I'm not sure how you guys are going to be able to do it. We're going to have to use a crystal ball because that development may never happen. But on the other hand, it might happen. So that's a tough one. I don't envy you on making that decision.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time hearing you. Did you say it's a stinky one or a sticky one?
I'll let you pick. Okay.
I think it's probably a little bit of both. So the photos on the lower end.
One other question since Gary stopped you there. I was just wondering, going back to that one slide that showed how rapidly the growth has occurred on this one substation. And don't know if it has occurred on any of the others in the county or not, but has this caused the conversation with the staff to say, is our premise of waiting till 70% still a valid premise?
That's another excellent question. And it's 80% is where
okay, we reached that, yeah.
And so that 80% was really developed based on about a 1% load growth a year. Right. And if you look at our capacities, 1% per year, it gives us about 3 years to start, you know, kind of planning in that, right, before we exceed that. In some cases, that does not work. And clearly, we need to have the ability to adjust from that. If we're seeing accelerated growth in a particular area, we need to be able to start planning at 60, 65, 70%. Versus 80%. And quite frankly, we're doing that in some areas. Manson is a really good example of where we're seeing exponential growth on some feeders, and we know that we need to accelerate our planning standards. And again, this is peak demand, so yeah. You know, we could see things flatten out if we see better temperatures for a year or two, but we really need to plan for the worst, hope for the best. In this case,
Are we applying these principles across the board as far as water and wastewater and fiber and all those certain things as we plan forward? You know, as accelerated growth, more demand on our systems, we need to probably look to all of our services, not just electric and our substations.
Yeah, certainly load forecasting or demand on our utility systems is something we're looking at across the board. For sure. The 80% is not universal to water and wastewater and fiber in terms of capacity standpoint. I think there's different variables that play into that. Clearly, as an example, on our wastewater systems, we may see a lot slower growth, right? So it may be 90%. And I don't know what that number is. I can certainly find out. But I know our engineers, our system planners are looking at load forecasting and demand on all utility systems on a regular basis.
One other question then, where do you draw the line? I think Gary kind of touched on it, was the load, organic load growth, and where, you know, developments do move in and kind of thing. How do you draw the line there where it's considered organic or impact on our system?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. What defines organic? And generally speaking, we refer to organic as our typical commercial, residential, and industrial customers that fall within that kind of that 0.5% to 1.5% load growth a year. Those fast instantaneous loads, as an example, when we went through the years of intense cryptocurrency where they just showed up today, their demand was online tomorrow, and we needed to respond to that, that would be considered non-organic growth, right? So let's use that hotel, the La Quinta, as an example. We have an application in hand, and it'll probably be 6 months or a year of planning and design for them. And then the construction, so you're talking about probably another year, and then the demand comes on load, or we see the demand maybe in year 2.5 or 3, right? Gives us some time to plan for that. That would be considered organic.
What about like up in Leavenworth where they're talking about 300 units going in, but that's over a given period of time. That's like 300 units all on the system at once. Would phasing in on that project like that be considered organic, or are you just going to look at the whole project and say, well, this is going to impact it, and now you have to deal with it?
Yeah, so from
even though they don't build, it takes time.
That's right. And from a load standpoint, you know, we appreciate the opportunity to look at the entire built-out phase, and that's what we'll want to build infrastructure for, is that entire built-out phase. Same thing on Mission Ridge. We want to know what that long-term total load impact is. But because they are built out in phases, and on the Mend property, we've known about that for multiple years now. We've been making plans and adjustments for that. We would consider that organic growth as well.
Oh, I see. Okay. Thank you.
I just want to draw your attention to what some of the early things that we can do before we build a new substation. As an example, in Mission Ridge, and we try to maximize the value of the existing assets that we have. In many cases, we can utilize the same pole systems and add a second circuit. So this shows on the left-hand side a single circuit distribution feeder. This is what is existing in the Mission Ridge corridor up the Squilchuck corridor. As a prelude to building a new substation, we would utilize the existing capacity of the existing substation and introduce a new distribution circuit. So on the right-hand side there, you can see that it goes from 3 conductors to 6 conductors on that pole. That's moving another electric circuit into that area, relieving pressure off that circuit. So going back to this slide, we could likely bring that circuit down to maybe 60% loading by introducing a second circuit. And again, these are just tools in our toolbox to relieve pressure in areas before we have to build those substations and corresponding transmission lines. Okay? And that's our plan in the Squilchuck area over the immediate horizon, into the next 2 to 3 years. Okay, so wrapping up, the new residential construction, it does remain steady throughout the county, and we are forecasting an additional 800-plus electric meters, similar to our historical loads. We have been getting some signaling for large single-family residential developments to kind of start slowing a little bit. And what I mean by that specifically is maybe they've started phase one, they're into phase two, but you know, phase three and four or five that were planned out, kind of starting to simmer down a little bit, focusing on probably moving everything in the earlier phases before they ramp up. So we're seeing that across the county. However, the result of that is no material shifts away from our substation planning, right? There's no direct need to stop or slow our substation planning. In fact, I would say this is a perfect time to get it where we need it. December 2022 introduced those new peaks that we went over. That resulted in maybe shifting a few of the priorities around, but not really introducing new infrastructure, just shifting what we already have planned. And our planned utility infrastructure, we believe, if we stay on course, we're well positioned to meet demand for our water, electric, wastewater, and fiber systems. The countywide planning efforts with the Chelan County Planning, the city municipalities, and others, other private developments, that's helping us make these forecasts. And of course, the advanced metering infrastructure, as that data starts to come in, which it is now starting to come in, that's really helping us understand energy demands in particular pockets of the county, and that will help increase our forecasting accuracy. So with that, are there any other questions?
Commissioners, questions?
I thought it was a very thorough presentation. In 2037, that's when we'll have the completion of the 47 substations. At that point, do you think that that's like the end of this phase and now we're looking at additional substations? Is that kind of how it works?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a good point. We're looking at out there at 2037. It's an aggressive plan, Commissioner Allen. It's more aggressive than any substation build plan that we've seen in the past. But based on our forecast, that's where we'll be. I would just say that those plans are based on these forecasts that we put together, and they could be accelerated or deaccelerated based on economic conditions and growth and expansion. The plan is relatively fixed in terms of what we need. The when we need it is what's variable.
So is the primary focus then land acquisition at this point, getting those nailed down?
Yes. Land acquisition has tended to be one of the most challenging components of building a substation, as well as transmission lines, getting the corridors and the rights of ways to do that. It's becoming more difficult in Chelan County for certain. So we advocate that we try to purchase those properties as early as we can and work with the communities to try to fit those in as early as we can. Generally speaking, that's the biggest bottleneck. Our design engineers, our procurement folks, our construction teams, those are difficult tasks, but they're not as subject to the same things property acquisition is, and permitting and property acquisition. So,
good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good question. Going back to transmission substation siting, I can remember back in 2016, and we were, that process up in Chelan. It took a while, and so now we're just now starting construction. We've learned some lessons. And those lessons that we learned, does that help facilitate moving forward with all of these different substation sitings? And have we improved our process and timing of doing this?
Yes. The answer is yes. We learned a tremendous amount from the North Shore substation property acquisition process. And we put those in place immediately, started in Leavenworth. Same year.
Okay.
And we have put those practices and principles in place also in the West Wenatchee substation area. And we are seeing efficiencies as a result of that.
That's what I'm asking about, yeah.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing efficiencies. However, I just say that it is a really heavy task, and it takes a lot of patience, a lot of good quality planned community outreach.
There you go.
Partnerships. We're limited on the people that we have to be able to do that. But we have also put together a documented approach, a documented standard for property acquisition for substations and transmission lines.
So that goes beyond what we're actually planning on now?
It goes far beyond what we're actually planning right now.
Okay.
But that outreach standard and that process is a new document that we've assembled using experiences and other subject matter experts, and we're following that today. We're on a good path.
I just personal comment. I don't think it's going to get easier. It's going to get more difficult for sitings and things like that as we move forward well beyond what we're planning for today. And so the forecast, or I guess the visioning, needs to be long range. If we want to have a smooth transition. So.
Yeah, good points. Thank you.
I know you're doing it. Comment. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Gary, anything?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, one final key takeaway, I wanted to make sure I got this accurate. what I need to share with Commissioner McKenna is in December, our system worked pretty much the way it was supposed to.
With a few exceptions.
Okay.
We got our arms around, and we've got some lessons learned there that we're applying as well.
I just couldn't resist that, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you.
You bet.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you, Andy.
All right, our next item is a design build overview for power delivery projects. Chad Bowman and Casey Hall.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Chad Bowman. I'm the Interim Director of Engineering and Project Management.
Good morning, Casey Hall, Project Manager.
We're here today to talk about another alternate delivery concept. There's two or three. This is yet another flavor. And we're really here to seek your support, really in the form of a head nod to begin the application process to the State Review Committee to use progressive design build for what we're calling power delivery projects. We would use these alternate project delivery methods and talk about lessons learned along the way from previous experiences. Casey's going to talk a little bit about the difference between progressive design build and traditional design build, and then how we might use progressive design build on some of those power delivery projects that are in our queue of upcoming activities. So, as you know, the district has used these alternative delivery methods, specifically GCCM or General Contractor Construction Manager. We're using that on our facilities projects. Casey is intimately involved in a few of those. And then you've heard from John Sagasser down at Rock Island, I think the last couple of commission meetings, about how we're using that at Powerhouse 2 in a number of different ways. Both with GE and some of the smaller contractors down there. So finally, what have we learned in terms of using these alternative delivery methods? How have those changed our project outcomes along the way? So we've really learned that it creates this a partnership between the district and the contractor, and it fosters this innovation and creativity between the design phase, the procurement phase, and the owner, where we're all working together to achieve the project outcomes instead of the more the traditional design bid build process, where at times we find ourselves at odds with the contractor in the form of field work orders and change orders. We've found that it reduces district resources, particularly in the area of procurement. Once we've signed the guaranteed maximum price contract with the contractor, a lot of that procurement is then done by the contractor. We see improved completion schedules where we're collaborating with the contractor along the way. And finally, reducing financial risk, where, especially in progressive design build, where we are going to establish the project estimate, the estimated completion at the 60% design stage, instead of much earlier as we do it in the traditional ways. And like I mentioned, reducing change order costs along the way because of that partnership that we've developed with the contractors part of that project. So Casey's going to talk a little bit about the difference between traditional design build, which we're again, here today, looking for your head nod to move that forward versus, progressive design build instead of traditional design build, and where we might use those in the future.
Yeah, thank you. So as Chad stated, the state of Washington allows another alternate delivery method that we haven't used at the district called progressive design build to public owners. And there's some key elements that are are differences between a traditional versus progressive. So that I'd like to point out that are shown on this slide. So first off is the selection process. So the contractor and its team is primarily based on their qualifications. So you're really looking at holistically at that team and what value they provide to the owner. You know, their qualifications, previous projects they've worked on, their experience, team that they're proposing to use on that project, all of those are taken into consideration in that selection process. The price for the work is progressed through progressive design build at different phases within that process. So you start off with your team, and it's an open book process that you work through with that team to come to a final point where you step away as the owner and issue that, what Chad was talking about, the guaranteed maximum price, set your price, and then let them take over the finishing, the design, and execution. The same can be said for the design. It works hands in hand with the price, where you work collaboratively with that team through those that process to a point in time where you establish that price with the contractor's team and allow them to finish that design. As Chad indicated, 60% is typical where that handoff happens, but depending on the complexity of the project, the owner's tolerance for where that handoff happens, it can actually go further than that into 90 to even 100% design. There's been projects like that. So another major difference is the contractor selection process. During the RFQ, you can actually select your contractor first and then select your design team later. What that does is that for an owner, if you have a real technical project where you know there's only a handful of firms out there in the field that actually can do that type of work, allows you to have that conversation early with the contractor before that selection is made to have them consider looking at those other firms. So with that being said, we see a huge value using this on our power delivery projects. Typically, these projects are very complex. They multiple phases over years. The procurements take years. Like our transformers, I was here a couple weeks ago talking about our transformer procurements taking a year and a half. So, and we're seeing that continually in the power market. This gives us the opportunity to work with that contractor early through the design process, trying to solve those issues that come up, and then also work through those procurements early so that we can have that material on site when we want to start work. So some of the projects we're looking at utilizing this on in that power delivery umbrella are our transmission line rebuild. So we have multiple transmission line projects that are coming up that are on the books. And we just talked about substations. We have connections that we'll have to bring into these yards that we could use that on. Our large interconnection loads and generator connections, similar to Microsoft's project, where we have a client come in that we execute an interconnection agreement with, and we need to turn around and give them power for their facility, and then also our future station projects. So next steps, again, as Chad mentioned earlier, we're seeking support from the commission to allow us to develop the application for the state project review committee. So we developed an application and then submitted to the PRC project review committee at the state level, and then for approval for this type of delivery method. Just to clarify, this is not to execute any contract under this method. It's just for approval to be able to use this method. Will come before the commission before any contract is executed under progressive design build. And so with your approval today, if there is support, we would plan on targeting the May 20th PRC project review committee application with the submission on, or excuse me, the presentation on June 22nd. So they have a month turnaround time.
Just to be clear, just looking for a head nod here. One of the questions they get asked when they go before the PRC is our board aware of this? So this is part of that process.
I've been sitting here during your presentation trying to figure out what would be the downside of doing this.
Right.
Yeah, I think that, talked about that. Downsides, Chad had talked about some of the things we've learned, design turnaround time, working as a team. You really have to take, I think that can be the downside. You have to embrace this process and really gain that trust with your contractor and that design team, similar to what we're doing at Rock Island, the GCCM projects. It's really, you have to take that team mentality and trust that, you know, you're all working to this end goal and you're not in a confrontational relationship with the contractor. So I think that there are things that are positive, but if you're not buying into the process, it can be negative.
Commissioner, it's a bit of a process too, in the sense that it's a collaborative. I've heard it referred to as partnering, though not as partners in the legal sense, with your contractor. So, you know, you see, because, well, you've seen John Sagasser come back periodically for additional approvals along the way. Those just takes a little more involvement along the way. I would say that, to me, the fundamental difference is it's an evolving, iterative type of contracting delivery process where you go in with, some really hard, you know, sideboards in your lane, but a little bit of ability to move in the range, and things shift a little, and you sort of learn as you go together. That's different than a traditional design bid build, which is, you know, we develop a design, put it on the street, and you get a hard number, period. Mm-hmm. Assuming that there's something, not something in the contract that would allow a cost adjustment. You know what you're building, you know how much it's going to cost, you know your timelines when you accept and award that bid contract. That's not exactly true in these concepts. So it's just a different relationship approach to project delivery. That's the way I'm going to say we in the law talk about the differences. One is more of a shared commitment. The other is just tell me what it's going to cost to install my hot tub.
And can you help me understand why we have to give approval? Is it because in the RCW it's
part of the state process? Yes. Okay. Commissioners, there's a period of time after which so many successful products that we can actually self-certify. We're probably getting close to that. At this point. And then we don't have to go back. But this was a relatively new concept. Actually, the whole concept, to be candid with you, back in days of yore, started with Safeco Field and have sort of progressively expanded over time to allow additional and different alternative delivery methods. So used in the right project, it's appropriate. I would say that, there were some pretty hard rules early on, some pretty high dollar thresholds, some very limited types of entities that could use it. Those have loosened over the time. I don't know, because I'm not the ones that make the decision, but I suspect that's because they're finding that there's value there. It is becoming more popular. There were harder rules, and the tail result of all of those harder rules loosening is we still have to go to the PRC for approval. We still have to let them know that you all are aware of the project and given your blessing to going and ask. You don't have to technically approve it by then, but you have to be aware of it. And then we're working toward that self-cert, which would allow us to make some of those decisions on our own. And that's your question?
Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Just in terms of understanding the process and maybe more validation of what I'm thinking, is that the design build provides additional flexibility that during these days of supply chain shortages and employment issues, where that extra flexibility allows the project to flow more smoothly and do so at maybe a cost that is equal to or less than what it might otherwise be if we had set really firm bookends. Is that kind of correct?
So I'll give you my response and then let Casey and Chad give you theirs, which is, depends. I would say that can be an outcome. I don't think any particular process is going to save the parties from themselves. So if there's just not a desire to achieve a common outcome, whether that's a original outcome or some modified version of an original outcome because of some development over time, parties still have to be willing to commit and go through the process and reach an agreement on the back end, or you're fighting about it and someone wearing a black robe will tell you what you get. I think, though, that your initial comment and sentiment is factually correct, in my opinion only, and that's that it does provide some additional flexibility to work through those kinds of issues that develop throughout the project. Those, frankly, that Casey and David and their teams manage all the time, without having to go through some of, in the law, what I think of as more formalities in terms of the contract amendments and additions and field work order change orders, which you all see all the time, and we do that because it's a perfectly appropriate way to manage a contract scope process to delivery. This, in my view, and this is not a one-to-one match or apples-to-apples comparison, but the system or the process in these sort of allow for that, the parties to get together and share their thinking and work things out before you ever really get to a, I'm going to say, a more formalistic, maybe like a field work order where we just tell them what to go do and send us a claim later. This is more of a collaborative approach to problem solving. So in that respect, I think your sentiment is correct. The parties should be in this and interested in exercising that flexibility to resolve those differences. Whether they choose to do it or not, that your crystal ball is as good as mine. I'll let Casey give you his answer. He's going to say yes. He's
an what Eric said. No, I think I can put it in just an example, too. I mean, our Microsoft project, again, let's go back to Transformers. Having a progressive design build team, you could be working collaboratively with them through that design process. And when you're ready to order Transformers, like the design set, you know what you need, you can let them order. They order them. You know, as formal process, right now we've got 13 procurements that we're trying to get through the design, bid, build, traditional style, and it just takes a lot of time where you can short some of that time up by, you know, ordering that material as design is complete. I think that's where you see that benefit, mm-hmm. where you could get that proactive approach where you're working with that team, making those procurements, trying to shorten that schedule down. But again, I think going back to Eric's statement, you have to be willing to work collaboratively with that team and set that goal up front that, hey, we've got to get this done by this time, and there's these things that we have to do, you know, in order to meet this date.
Just seems to me that the collaborative approach at the end of the day will pay dividends that may go beyond just dollars and cents also. I mean, right. A willingness of a contractor, when you're working collaboratively, to go the extra mile, maybe it's even just an extra inch to get over a hurdle. I think there's a lot to that.
Yeah, I agree. I've, you know, as Chad indicated, I've been working on the GCCM contract with Leidig at Rocky Reach for the last 5 years, and it's, I think if it was traditional design build, I probably, all my hair would have been falling out. So it's been a great project, and I think that type of contract allowing you to work as a team with a contractor has been great. And those things, Randy, that you're talking about are happening where a contractor goes the extra mile because you're there as a team trying to get mm-hmm. to the end, and they're there to help you. I mean, they all we're all working together.
Yeah. So commissioners, they're not asking for a vote, but you know, head nod, if you will.
Or as the lawyers always phrase it, any objections.
Yeah.
Sound. No, I just process can be cumbersome. And I think this is what you're trying to address is the way I look at it, that anytime you can streamline the process, red tape, whatever you want to call it, is a good thing, and it will help facilitate. I see it would help facilitate our construction job. So no, I have no problem with it.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you both. Hmm.
Next item, agenda item number 5, is the Public Power Benefit Fiber Program update with Bob Shane and John Stoll. And this is actually a follow-up from our August 15th meeting where we identified we were going to go use a team of teams approach to go look at where we're at with the Public Power Benefit Project. And that's been done since then. And Bob and John are here to report back and talk about future.
Thank you, Kirk. Good morning, Commissioners. Bob Shane, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom.
John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. Good morning.
Good morning.
Commissioner Berger, and if I can back up to the question you had earlier about capacity mm-hmm. of training, planning. So on the fiber side, just like to throw this out there, we have similar metrics in place where we look at the bandwidth use of our network. And we do have thresholds at each of our different nodes for different applications. And much like Andy had shared, we anticipate what that growth will be, and we start planning replacement of equipment or capacity as part of that process. We do see the bandwidth usage. That's what we look at. That's comparable to the power, I would suppose. We see that bandwidth usage climbing very quickly. And so we're constantly looking ahead to see where we have to replace equipment to keep up with that. That's just part of our process. It's not as complicated as what John Group has to go through to physically change stuff out, but just the same. It's a matter of performing and meeting customers' expectations to make sure that we don't have latency or congestion on the network. It's a little bit compounded by the fact that a lot of the services that put of our network, not a lot of them, all of them go through our service providers. So they have their part in maintaining their networks as well to make sure that it doesn't bottleneck at their point. So we work with them as well to make sure that we're always talking about the overall performance of the network, to make sure we deliver the best for our customer. I just wanted to share that since I had that.
No, thanks, I appreciate that.
So as Kirk said, we're here to bring forward what we had discussed in August about the fiber program, and hopefully when we get through here, I have a very good idea of what our plans are going forward. We'll back up and talk a little bit about the strategic plan as originally set. We'll also give you an update on some of the activities that we've undergone since then. There'll be a staff analysis that John will be talking through. We will talk about the impacts of growth that's been fairly considerable for the fiber team as it is for the district on the electrical side. And we will have some program recommendations for your consideration. So backing up on what we had established originally with the fiber program, you'll recall that we had a target of 9,256 premises, pretty precise, for about $25 million. And the plan was to complete that project by the end of 2026. And at that time, we would have a total coverage county of about 85-90%. And as you also remember, we had the remaining portion of the counties that we were going to consider it looking at serving by some alternative technology as a possibility. We do continue the program into 2027. That's basically to complete the connection. So the first part of the program is building the infrastructure to bring light to the customers, and then the last part of it is connecting the last few customers that want connected. There is also the expansion portion of that. We do plan on having that completed by the end of 2024. And recall, we brought forward some of the expansion areas to get that completed sooner. There was an additional $2 million added to do that, and we're on track to meet that. And if recall, also, this is public power benefit, so there's no additional cost to our customers to make these expectations.
So, Commissioners, I have the next couple of slides. Just wanted to talk about the approach we use. Kirk mentioned the team of teams approach. I actually brought the book. It's a book that actually about a year ago, the Customer Utilities Leadership Team, we all got copies. And just a good book to go through. It actually details, it was General McChrystal, who actually during, I think, the Iraq War, just needed to get better information, more agile, be able to adapt quicker. Really good read. So when we got to the point after Bob's presentation in August and just a lot of moving pieces, we thought, could we use the team of teams approach to really take a look and support fiber and Bob? And so with Kirk and Bob's approval, we did that. So we brought in other folks who really asked them to really be dedicated to work with Bob and Jennifer, as well as Chad Rissman. So Chad Bowman and his team at EPM was part of that. We've got a group called the GIS group. That stands for the Geographical Information System. So these guys are wizards when it comes to putting information together in a graphical display. So they really modeled the system looking at it that way. And through that, we were able to, I think, glean some better information that really helps inform decision making. Again, they took, time out of their normal job to really focus on this. So, it took some time to get that information, but in the end, I think it was a really good process to go through. So just some of the details we did really go through and uncover the list of addresses, where we're at as far as metrics and where pass-bys and infill opportunities. And that gave us, validation that the targets were there. And so that also gave us, I think, a common language to speak to as we were looking towards hitting this goal. So, again, a really good outcome. So going forward, and that's where we're here today, is it really gave us a look at, well, what is it going to take? And, it says internal versus external labor resources. And right now we're using both. There's a lot of external contractors that are on site doing both the expansion. We use them for infill. We've got the customer utilities group that spends a lot of time supporting it, as well as EPM's group. So, again, it gave us a look at what is it going to take? Do we have enough resources? Can we meet the goal? And with that, we developed a recommendation, and I'll let Bob hit the punchline.
Yeah, so we're definitely on track to meet the expectations of the PPB program, and that was to hit 85% by the end of the program. And we'll have more detail about the breakup of the premises that will pass, which I think you'll find interesting. The county growth impact was something that was very interesting for us. It's difficult for us to really anticipate what that might be, although we do see some trends. But definitely it far exceeded what we originally planned and looked at it back in 2015. The growth was pretty nominal. And we felt that any work, any growth that would develop at that point was small enough that we could have just absorbed that into the fiber program without asking specific money from the PPB program. We found that's not quite the case. Since then, there's been very large multi-dwelling units developing, as Andy had talked about before, in some substantial subdivision being developed. We simply couldn't absorb that cost-wise into the standard fiber program as a ratepayer, so we did look at using the PPB funding to help fund some of that, and we'll talk about the breakdown here. But the bottom line, those premises that were entered or added to the county under the multi-dwelling units and large subdivisions are part of the PPB program, both in the dollar amount and in the premises count portion, and we'll talk about that here in a little bit. So here's it's a little bit busy, but I think it's pretty straightforward if we get through this here. So the top two lines basically is what's making up the PPB program as we see it and what we forecast. So under the achieved column, under the original scope, that is the folks, the residences that we originally identified, we had 4,200 of those achieved to date. That's the expansion and the acceleration we spoke about. Well, we also added 1,321 new premises that were related to growth, whether it be subdivisions, multi-dwelling units of that type there. Going forward for the rest of the program, those are the amounts. We still think we'll hit 2,400 about on the PPB original scope, and then additional 1,300 expected on the new growth as we go forward. That totals our 9,256 for the program. At the same time, we realize we're going to actually achieve more than that overall for the system. So going toward the 85% county growth, we're also expecting to be adding, if you look down below, you have the routine growth of 2,241. And then you have the additional 1,000 or so that we see going forward. So if you total that all up between the PPB program of 9,256, which is the original scope plus some division, and then what we're going to do routinely, that is non-PPB funded growth areas, we're going to hit 12,541 new premises added to the network at the end of 2026. We're pretty proud of that. That's quite the effort, quite the accomplishment there. I'll pause on that one because that's got a lot of stuff in there, but does that make sense?
It totally makes sense to me, but also with the new developments that are coming in, that, you know, that 85% mark that we're reaching for is a moving target. I mean, it's not, 85% 6 years ago was a whole lot different than what we're looking at today. That's at 85%. Right. So it could be one of these goalposts that just keeps moving out forever. Yep. As growth. That's why I see it. I hope that down the road that we just defined a service territory and say this is where we need to service, because it's a 85% is ambiguous. It just keeps moving away. I'm not sure what that means anymore.
You're going to like the recommendation then.
Yeah.
What's that?
You're going to like the recommendation then.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is...
No,
this
you're is, right. You're yeah, absolutely
this
right.
This is a serious you're thing right. that right. We never get there. It's one of those things like chasing the rainbow.
Yeah, you're right. It's been a challenge, and they're going to speak to that.
Okay.
You're absolutely right. So this is just another view of that chart just to help bring the point. So in the top line, the 2015 is the original premises pass. Down below that at 2026, we expect 21% of the total PPB premises passed will come through new growth or subdivisions. And then the additional 26% is going to be the routine growth. So that's totals that 12,500 overall.
Okay, so here we are at the recommendation. And I've got the first couple of bullets, but one of the things we want to do is just continue on. We utilize Customer Utilities Group and our processes for the growth and infill. And then on the expansion areas, continue on the road with engineering and project management and delivering that effort. And throughout that, it's interrelated. We all work together because it's how it works. So continue on with that.
So develop plans for the future expansion finalization. Commission, this is what you're referring to. So we would like to go back and...
Should have read that again.
Yes. Take a look at what we have ahead of us. Learn from what we've done so far. Apply that going forward and come back to you at a later date and basically provide you what we would call the finalization, coming to a point where we'd be comfortable saying that the fiber expansion is completed and that we have enough internal inertia to keep up with the growth as it goes forward. The growth is unknown. So the growth could slow down, and it's easier to hit the 85%. It could speed up and then be a challenge. But we're going to try to put a plan together that comes back that incorporates the dynamics around what that might be looking forward, not knowing exactly what we have ahead of us. So we'd like to come back with a progress report on trying to address how we're going to finalize this program, what metrics we're going to be using, what areas we're going to go to. One of the things that I understand has been a challenge for the commission is telling our customer owners if you're in or out of the fiber mm-hmm. program or expansion program. That will be one of the things that we will focus on so you have clear communications about the scope of what it is we're going to be doing. So we still have the known unknowns. The supply chain issue continues to be a challenge for us. We tend to be stay ahead of it through some good planning and forecasting, so we're doing pretty good there. Scope complexity, easements is always an uncertain thing and tied back to the scope complexity and the type of work we do. Some of the work we're doing requires some make-ready work, bringing the infrastructure into alignment to where we want to be. Those are good things. We're taking those as opportunities to do both the fiber work and also improve our physical plan on the electrical side. But it does add a complexity to the overall cost. The cost of inflation, we'll have to see how that works out in terms of materials. Easements I talked about, but it's a big part of what we do. Very collaborative, very community-centric, so we do a lot of outreach to make sure that the easements are we're obtaining those when we need them and where we need them. Contractor availability, there are billions of dollars being released in the federal fund for broadband build-out. And so those resources are being tapped by many, 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 many areas of the county. And so that puts a strain on the availability of the external contractors should we decide to use those.
And just lastly, competing priorities. You've seen a lot of that already, even from Andy's presentation. We had a lot going on with growth and substations. Wildfire issues continue to be a big issue we're working through. We've got goals on reliability to improve that. So, again, it's just lots going on.
So we'd like to leave you with some key takeaways. We are on track to meet the goals of the original PPP program, that is to get 9256 by the end of 2026. That's been nothing but a team effort. It's a lot of work. A lot of different resources, but we've been working really hard to meet those objectives. We certainly recognize the value of the fiber to the community. I will tell you, one of the proudest things for me is to go in the community, and people don't know me until they say, what do you do? And I say, I'm in the fiber program. They go, oh, come here, we want to. or not. But it's an indication that what we're doing as a community, for the community, is awesome, and we appreciate what the board has done in support of that. It's really recognized by the public. More when they don't have it than it is when they do have it, but still it's an indication that the demand is there and we'll continue to meet that. And we need some time to develop what that bigger holistic plan would be. We'd like to come back to you later on this year with a proposal or recommendations how we would like to go forward for your consideration. With that, I'll turn it over to any questions or comments or guidance.
Commissioners, any question?
I'd just like to maybe...
I'd like to just...
Go ahead, Commissioner Arsenault.
No, you started, Kurt.
I was just going to say, I really appreciate the team that worked on this. It was not an easy task, and as they pointed out, it was... we had people from multiple departments that hadn't done a deep dive on fiber, and so you got that diverse perspective from different areas taking a good look at it. And I think the thing that really is beneficial of doing that is it kind of challenges the status quo, if you will. And I think the other benefit is you get a broader ownership, if you will, in the organization on something that's key to strategic planning, one of our strategic goals. It's not just one department. It's how do we collectively, as multiple departments, work together to try and help out and achieve that goal. I think a couple things have changed since the original goal that are important to point out. As Bob mentioned, the growth consideration was different than what we expected, and so there was an adaptation along the way. And then the commitment for the make-ready work and making sure that all the expansion work we were doing and all the build-out was in compliance with codes was a significant effort along the way as well. I think a combination of those things and then the recognition that Commissioner Berger and you pointed out of this 85 to 90% as a moving target is really hard to get your arms around. It's easy to calculate. But it's hard from a customer-centric perspective to be able to tell people you're in or you're out. And that changes as you go through the process to define, you know, what we're trying to do with the amount of money we have and the 85 to 90%. It does result in some customers, you know, potentially being part of the plan and then not part of the plan. And so we really want to try and address that going forward on the plan for finalization. But I just wanted to share from my perspective just some of the interesting dynamics that this team of teams uncovered with Bob's support and John's support as well. And I'd also add that Kelly Boyd and Justin Erickson were also involved helping the team look at the data and understand what it was telling us and where we'd go from here. So,
Gary.
Thank you. I just want to say it was really informative to hear the approach that's being taken. Pretty exciting to continue to see how it unfolds as it moves forward. And Bob, I just wanted to also tag on what your comment. I don't think I've ever been involved in a project that has been so visible throughout the county as fiber. And you're absolutely right. You know, we have a lot of folks out there very appreciative of having fiber. And of course, those people that haven't yet received it are anxious to do so, and so there's a willingness to discuss it wherever you are in the county. And so I appreciate this second look, really, to take a look at how we can expand it even further and fill in some of those donut holes. That's great. So good job.
Thank you, Commissioner.
One other thing, you say you're going to come back with a plan.
Yes.
One thing I would like to hear is an expected completion date along with that plan.
What was that?
A completion date.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be, you know, in cement, but, you know, just expected timeline.
That would be within the expectations of the teams to come back with some type of scope, schedule, and budget, basically.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Add one thing. So before taking my position, of course, fiber was a hot topic in the Manson community. So it's been really interesting following this whole process with you guys, and I'm very fascinated by the team of teams approach. It seems like that's very beneficial. So excited to read the book.
I think we have a few copies lying around.
It's interesting that you mentioned that fiber was a hot topic when you ran for election. I ran for election in 2006. Fiber was a hot topic in 2006.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't it awesome knowing that what you do matters? Yes.
No, it's always been an issue.
I'm excited about seeing what you propose this fall. Really am.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I just want to correct. Bob, I'm sorry. I've referred to you as Shane first. It's Bob. I know it's Bob. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no problem. Both
there's,
of it.
There's some other Shanes around.
It's better than my initial.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
I'm going to put that on the bottom good. Footer of every one of your presentations now. It's BS.
Any other comments from any member of the public? Okay.
Thank you for
Thank
your time.
You. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thanks for your hard work.
So we're about half hour ahead of schedule, and maybe we can get through a significant part of our afternoon agenda if we work at it, but we do have public comment right here is item 6, so I'll open up for any public comment at this moment in time. Okay. So hearing none, why don't we see how far we can go on our afternoon agenda. All right. We have a consent agenda before us that has been modified to add Resolution 11 as part of the consent agenda. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
I would make such a motion.
You get second, Gary. You get second.
All right.
Okay.
I'll second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. We're on to resolution number 9. No, 10. Pardon me.
Okay. Agenda item number 10. Come on up, Salim. This is a resolution authorizing amendment number 5 to service agreement number 21-11984 with McMillan Incorporated of Boise, Idaho for professional engineering services for the Rock Island Spillway Gate Handling Improvements. And just as you heard Chad and Casey talk about alternative procurement deliveries, this is not one of those, but I will say it's a very innovative approach that we have not used, at least from what I can recall. Where we actually have a couple of engineering firms compete against each other for design concepts. And so Salim's here to talk about the next step with this contract.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Salim Ghazi. I'm one of the project managers at Rock Island Dam. So this resolution is requesting an authorization to amend our existing service agreement 21-11984 with Macmillan Inc. that we have. This will add, I'm asking to increase the contract amount by $1.2 million to then the total amount would be $1.8 for if the resolution passed. So just a brief background. In 2022, we hired two companies, Macmillan Inc. and one other consultant company to develop some 30% design concepts for the Rock Island gate handling. Our spillway have some challenges that we hired them to develop some concepts. And hiring two companies was, like Kirk mentioned, was good to compete, come up with the out-of-the-box thinking, more innovative ideas, and come up with more concept that we can review and select some. So in about September of 2022, we completed the 30% design. The project team selected, after reviewing both reports, they selected to move forward with Macmillan Inc. with their concepts to go beyond 30% design to 100% design. So that was the recommendation that we came up with. So in order to implement that, we have to move to 100% design. So we selected some of the concepts that we think would be very, we should try in the field and test them. So this 100% design request money is for that, to get to the 100% design. They're going to, Macmillan will also support us for the preparing bid support and some other communication with FERC. So we call this as the concept that was selected. I'm just going to, we have notch gates. Now, I'm not sure if you're familiar, notch gates are openings that in the that we open them for spill, so that the fish for the fish spill during the season. Then we have they came up with a new concept of a deck mounted hoist. All of our hoist right now is overhead design, and this is would be a deck mounted hoist which would be at the ground level, which would have a lot of benefits. Also, we want to maximize the storage space on the spillway. Right now, the one of the challenges we have is we have a lot of manual handling, and we have to take the leaf sections that we remove them off the spillway because our gauge storage is not maximized. So we were wanted to, they came up with a very good storage concept that we want to apply. And then also we want to have new gauge sections in a couple of bays and fabricate them with a lighter design, which are lighter weight. Our old construction is very heavy weight and it requires much higher capacity crane. So in order to move forward, so those are the concept that we want to move forward to 100% design. And so they will provide the bidding support. So what I'm requesting is $1.2 million to be added to the existing service agreement for the total of $1.8 million. It will extend the date, completion date with the design and all the reviews till end of 2024. We have money, most of this money will be spent in 2023, and I think we have it in the budget. Any questions?
Commissioners, any questions?
Yes, if you don't mind. I had the great fortune of going to Rock Island last week.
Okay.
And I believe one of the items presented about the gates is that they are inconsistent as well. They're and that causes some problems in understanding how to utilize them. And
you're right. Yeah.
So will this design then be bringing that standardization to them?
That's the objective at the end, that we want to standardize the deck. For example, deck, we have several kind of hoist designs out there over the last, since 1930s when there was built. Yeah. We want to standardize the hoist design.
Okay.
So this deck mounted hoist, the notch gates would be all same design, and then we'll have much better maintainability also.
Great.
So, yeah.
Any other questions? Well, thank you. And I want to, even though you don't know that I need to apologize to you, I do, because when I asked for public comment, I was looking at you, and I did not recognize you.
All right.
And I will not forget you now. So
all right.
Thank you for that presentation.
Thank you.
You bet.
I appreciate it.
You bet. Commissioners, is there a motion to approve resolution number 11?
So moved.
I'll second it.
Been moved and seconded. Oh, approve resolution 10. I apologize. Oh. Resolution 10. Thank
That's
you.
That's the one I marked.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded to approve resolution number 10. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion is carried. Manager items.
I've got one manager item, and I'd like to call. I thought Brett was here.
Brett was in his room a minute ago.
Here he is.
There he is. Brett Pickford. You might recall we had a pier crack on the spillway a couple years ago, and we've actually had quite a bit of monitoring, and Brett's here to update us on a couple of more that have developed recently. Brett?
Yep. We have one photo up there. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so our dam safety team does monthly monitoring of all of our hydro projects, and so taking a series of pictures over the past couple of months and comparing them over the past couple of years, particularly since we've been doing work at the Rock Island Spillway, we've noticed we see some water staining and a phenomena called efflorescence, which is basically that crystalline salt that develops on concrete and other porous surfaces, so that white kind of staining that you see there has been starting to grow. So we've been monitoring that over several months, and it appears that here at Pier 15, that a crack is starting to develop along that line by which we want to start performing some remedial work to it. So we've also been performing detailed inspections along the complete spillway. And there's one other location at Pier 7 that it looks like this efflorescence is growing. And so we've done an analysis here at Pier 15, an engineering analysis at this time. There's not any impacts to spillway capacity, traffic, moving gates, moving cranes. But it's something that we want to address as soon as possible. Pier 7, we just is the second location where we've seen some of this staining. We did some ROV inspections over the weekend. It's really hard to see with the footage that we got if there's cracking or not, but we believe there is, since there's some of this efflorescence showing. It's not nearly as extensive as Pier 15, so we're not as concerned about that. We believe that what is causing this phenomena is expansion stresses that are caused by temperature changes. We had some real extreme heat in the summer of 2021. Again, it was pretty warm as well. The water surface or water temperatures, as well as ambient temperatures, we think, and we're doing some monitoring to actually see what kind of concrete temperatures and water temperatures we've had, so we can track over the decades how that's affecting the structure. So we're proposing to start work to help reduce the stresses that are being caused by expansion and contraction. Why they're occurring at this point in time in its life is that the existing expansion joints have closed up because of concrete growth that's slowly occurring at Rock Island Dam. And so we're proposing to go back and relieve those joints and provide extra room at about an inch or two so that they can expand and contract. And if you're not familiar with expansion and contraction, you can see it in our highways and our sidewalks and curbs. It's something that is designed in. And here we've, over the 90 years of the operation, we've lost that. So we're going to go back and restore that. Restoring that is challenging at the spillway because there's a number of embedded electrical conduits and communications in the deck. We've already done some relocation work a couple years ago, and so we can more rapidly remediate those expansion joints on what we call the north half of the spillway. But we will need to relocate the conduits on the electrical and the conduits on the second half of the south end of the spillway before we can relieve those expansion joints. So we'll be working on that. We've notified the FERC regional office, and they don't have any concerns. We'll be putting some crack monitoring devices on so we can monitor that as the temperature of the water and heats up over the summer to see what's happening there. Is there any questions?
100 years and the concrete grows a little bit. Will it continue to grow throughout its life?
We believe it will. But we believe also at a diminished rate. It's probably been at a higher rate in the past.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you so much for taking so much time with me last week. It's so helpful, though, you know, and I felt lucky to be there when you guys were really looking at the crack. But it is helpful when the resolutions come forward and understanding what's going on.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
I think one question, it involves the, I guess, the seeping. I can't remember what you call it, but the seeping there. Do you notice it at, is it different at different times of year? Is it more or less, or is this just something you just look at as an annual thing? Well, it's actually getting bigger, but do we know when that is? Or I guess that's what you're going to do with the temperature and the water and those sorts of things. But, you know, I just was curious, you know, if it's in the springtime, summertime, winter.
Yeah, we expect it, and so that's what we're going to be trying to tracking this year, is expect that the crack width here, they're still fairly tight together. There's not a separation.
Yeah.
But we would expect kind of in the August time frame
that when it would
that we would see maybe the most water flow or the most movement, because this is a bending phenomena. Okay. As it's expanding, it's pushing at the roadway deck, and so the piers are, and this is what we believe is a tension crack, because it's just on this face, it's not on the other face.
Okay.
And we see the growth is going to the north.
Oh, okay. All right. Thanks. Appreciate that.
I also would add that this is not a static situation. It's a dynamic situation that I would expect us to, you know, just as we experienced a crack a couple years ago and took care of some of the expansion joints, and now we're seeing more, I would expect us to continue to see more as things shift out there. And, you know, we'll also consider the project that Salim was just talking about, the whole spillway modernization effort. There'll be a lot of work that will go into these expansion joints and maybe even doing more things. You know, there's all kinds of different ways to address this, but I would expect this as an almost 100-year-old project to be continually doing some of this work.
So does Rock Island in your budget, you just have a big repair pool there?
Well, one of the things we are talking about is, you know, looking at the contracts that we're going out with soon on not only this, but the modernization and adding that element of ongoing work that would be associated with concrete rehabilitation, expansion, contraction, joints, and those types of things. So it is, I don't expect us to be done with this, you know, when, you know, these repairs are done. I think we'll just constantly have a number of things we'll be doing out there mm-hmm. as we monitor it.
Yeah, these type of concrete repairs will be in our O&M budgets, and so it's not so easy to see those, but there's the large capital project that we're doing the evaluation on that Salim was talking about. Mm-hmm. That one will be a defined project where we look at the number of spillway hoists that we need to provide, gates, things like that.
Thank you.
So I have a question. This was really spurred. Kirk, you just said something that caused me to think. The Rocky Reach project was built in the 60s, or pardon me, the 50s. And so we're getting pretty close to, you know, over 70 years on that project. Are we beginning to see any of these kinds of issues appeared at Rocky Reach?
You want to take that, Brett?
Sure.
There's a difference.
Yeah. At Rocky Reach.
Good question.
We have been monitoring for this concrete growth. And we don't see that. We've taken samples of the concrete and have about in the 50s, it became much more well known about the mixing of concrete and the aggregate that you use and the silica that you use. And so this concrete growth issue had kind of been known, and they were very careful on the materials that they used in their concrete. So they were careful, it was documented, and we do not see it at Rocky Reach.
So it's just dams that are pre-50s that you probably have the major concern with?
That's where in the United States.
Yeah.
It wasn't Rangoon as well known. And the material sourcing and stuff was different. So they didn't have the knowledge until they built them and saw it until they learned lessons learned going forward. So
interesting.
But yeah, we're fortunate. There are a number of projects in the United States that have it very severely. And so it's even much more challenging for them to be able to manage that.
It's good to know that we're staying right on top of it. That's
yep.
where we want to be.
Yep. Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That's all I had.
All manager items.
Yep.
Lisa, Commissioner Travel.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We have some trouble with Waputa coming up. Commissioner Arsenault, I changed your hotel as requested. Commissioner Allen, I sent you a follow-up question on your hotel request.
Okay.
Just FYI. I have Commissioner Arsenault attending Waputa in May for the telecom workshop. May 15 through 17 is the NWPPA annual conference. I have Commissioners Arsenault and Smith attending
mm-hmm.
that. Mm-hmm. In June, we have Waputa via Zoom. But I think Commissioners McKenna and Arsenault are planning to attend.
Is that the strategic planning?
Yes.
Yeah, that's committee chairs and executive committee members. Others are welcome, I guess, to sit in. But yeah, so I won't be there.
You're out?
I'm out.
Okay.
I've been there.
Okay. For the APPA National Conference, I want to check with Commissioner Berggren on your hotel dates when you plan to check in and check out. We can do that outside of here.
Oh, they, are you talking about in July?
June.
Or June in Seattle.
Is there a day of giving involved? I have not looked at the information yet.
There is.
You know, with just this is just a thought, but as one commissioner, with everything we have struggled with in Eastern Washington, might be a great opportunity for us to get firsthand on the ground exposure to issues in Seattle with in that Day of Giving. I mean, Day of Giving is a powerful tool to get an understanding of a community needs, and Seattle has community needs, and so. This could be an opportunity for us.
I can send that out. There are a few different options for that day to
take a look at it.
Participate in.
I mean, I'm sure that we've all formed certain thoughts and processes, but it's a good opportunity.
Okay. So I'll send that out, and you can all just let me know. I will modify your or update your registrations to include that information. Mm-hmm. And in July, Commissioner Arsenault is going to Arlington for the APPA Policymakers Council. Does anyone else plan to attend that? No.
No.
I would like to go.
Okay. And I'll follow up with you on dates and
perfect.
That sort of thing. Okay, then out to September, I don't have anything booked or scheduled out that far.
Okay.
Have any questions? Can I help with anything?
No, I'll look at the email.
Okay.
I'll talk to you before I leave.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you.
No problem.
Do we have any other commissioner items? Follow up on delegation of action items from previous board meeting?
I do have a couple. I don't have any updates from the March 6th board meeting, but I do have an update from the March 23rd board workshop. There were a couple of action items for follow up. One of those was Rebecca will meet with Commissioners McKenna and Allen to review board balance scorecard metrics after the board governance workshop. Yet to be scheduled, but working on it. And then Eric will meet with Commissioner Smith and Allen to review the board governance policies after the board governance workshop as well. Right. And had one item for today, and that was Andy Wendell will provide planning thresholds for water and wastewater for Commissioner Berggren's request.
Okay.
The fiber one was handled on Bob and John. So.
Right.
And that's it.
And anything from today? Delegation. That was it. That was that. Okay. I don't think we have any additional public comment as there's nobody in the room. we are in need of an executive session which we should at this point recess and reconvene at 1 o'clock. Will we reconvene then into executive session? Is that? Pardon?
You can read it now.
I will go ahead and read us into executive session because we will be reconvening in executive session at 1 o'clock for approximately 1 hour to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the director or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCWs. That's for 1 hour. And we'll stand in recess until 1 o'clock.
We get a long line.
It is 2 p.m. on April 3, 2023. We have been in executive session for approximately 1 hour. No votes were taken. No decisions were made. Is there any other business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we stand adjourned.